Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. On November 6th, Massachusetts voters will decide whether terminally ill adults have the right to end their lives. If passed, the ballot measure called the Death with Dignity Act would make Massachusetts the fourth state to allow terminally ill patients to take their own lives, actually the third state. Joining me now to discuss the ballot measure are Dr. Marcia Angel, the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Dr. Linda Young, the immediate past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. So sometimes this is called physician-assisted suicide. Dr. Young, what particular problem do you think this poses for physicians? Because I know that this is not a ballot measure that you're in support of.
That's correct. Actually, the Massachusetts Medical Society does have policy now that we are against physician-assisted suicide or whatever other names that are there that Dr. Angel, I know, can go into. I think the majority of our members that made these decisions feel that it is basically unethical, and it goes against what a physician has pledged to do when they take either the Hippocratic Oath or whatever oath it is that they take when they graduate from medical school.
So, Dr. Angel, why do you think that this is something that you can support then, because you are a physician?
Yes. You know, in my mind, the real question is, why would anyone oppose it? This act merely permits dying patients who find their suffering unendurable and who can't find the relief that they want. It permits such patients to ask their physician for a medication that would allow them to end their lives somewhat earlier. I mean, they're dying, remember that. To end their lives somewhat earlier and more peacefully. I can't see that this would be a threat to anyone. It's their choice. They don't have to ask for the medication, and it's the doctor's choice as to whether he or she wants to comply. So it's simply a matter of choice. Why would anyone, the state, organized medicine, why would anyone want to tell someone else how much suffering they have to endure as they face death?
So as I said, there are two states that have virtually identical laws, Washington State and Oregon, and it allows for a lethal dose of secanol, which is a barbiturate. You mix it with water or juice, and you take it that way. The people who are allowed under law to participate in this have to be mentally competent. In other words, they have to know what they are doing. It must part of this be witnessed by a non-family member, so there is less chance of coercion. And it's a process which asks, in which the patient has to ask the doctor twice, that's verbally, and then once in writing before the procedure goes forth. I wanted to give people a chance to hear a little bit of a clip from a documentary called How to Die in Oregon. This aired on HBO and won a number of awards at Sundance. And it features two people who made the decision to take the secanol. One is an older man who is about 70, and apparently that's about the median age of people who decide to do this. And another is a younger woman who suffering from extreme breast cancer, and both of them speak. So you'll hear the older man first and then the younger woman.
Before you take the medication, I'm going to ask you just two questions again.
Sure.
You have the right to change your mind.
My mind's not changing.
And what will this medication do?
It will kill me and make me happy.
Death with dignity. The other side calls it assisted suicide.
I was diagnosed with cancer. I was supposed to have 6 months. It's this curious limbo. You don't know what's really going to happen.
So, Dr. Young, the last voice we heard there was a younger woman, as I mentioned, and she hit upon one of the issues for you and many other physicians in the Massachusetts Medical Society, why you're opposed to this, and that
yes.
is, she said, you know, I was given 6 months to live, but no one can really predict the exact end of life.
That is correct. And that is one of the things that was brought up. The decision that we came to for the Medical Society was just a reaffirmation, as we call it, of our policy. And there was very, very passionate debate on both sides. It did end up being about 178-54 vote to continue to oppose this. But that's exactly one of the things is 6 months. Many times you're right, but what if you're wrong? And that has happened. And that was one of the compelling arguments that convinced a lot of our members that perhaps this was not a good thing to support.
So what doctors do, just to be clear, is they look at the individual's condition, and then they also gather what data may be there for that particular illness.
Yes.
And then try to put that together and come up with something that's a really pretty good educated guess. But that's what it is.
It is an educated guess. It's a prediction. And many times that unfortunately is correct. But there are other methods and other ways to help alleviate a patient at the end of life. But I think one of the biggest problems that we have is what if we're wrong about that diagnosis and we take away perhaps a significant amount more of a patient's life.
So how do you answer that, Dr. Marcia Angel?
Well, the law, the identical law, has been in effect now in Oregon for nearly 15 years. And the state keeps very careful, detailed records of how it's used. No law works absolutely perfectly, but this one, as far as I can see, comes about as close as possible. The experience over 15 years has been extraordinarily good and positive. In terms of the 6 months question, in Oregon, the great majority of people had widely disseminated cancer, and nearly all of them were getting hospice care at that time. So the fact that they were imminently dying, you would be hard put to say that you didn't know that.
So it's not a question of 6 months. It's maybe it's 8 months, but it's going to be soon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the other, I think the next largest group were people who had end-stage emphysema and then people who had Lou Gehrig's disease who were toward the end of that disease. So I don't think this is nearly the issue that it's being made out to be.
Well, in fact, what is true is that in both states, some of the fears around people being coerced or the dates being off wildly, because there are good examples, to Dr. Young's point, of people being told 6 months and they live 3 years. So how do you evaluate whether or not you know what you would lose in that time period. But overall, a lot of those fears went away, that there hasn't been as much of that as the opponents of this of those laws feared.
None of it, as far as we can see. This law has been used exactly as it was intended to be used. Can I say just one word about the terminology, too? The proponents like the term physician-assisted dying. The opponents like the term physician-assisted suicide. Mm. And as a proponent, let me say that my reason for choosing physician-assisted dying is that it distinguishes this kind of assisted dying from the typical suicide in which someone, usually a younger person, with a normal life expectancy chooses death over life. Here, unfortunately, these patients don't have that choice. They are dying. They're just choosing the manner of their death.
For people who are, you know, driving off the edge of the road right now and screaming at the radio, I am clearly aware that there is a moral component to this. I'm talking to two doctors. One is Dr. Marshall Angel, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Dr. Linda Young, former president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. So we're talking about pro and opposition based around where the physicians are and a little bit more. And I'm steering a little bit clear of the moral debate about it. Though, let me say this. Massachusetts is the most Catholic state, and the church is opposed here on moral grounds. And some believe that that's the reason why other attempts to bring this ballot question to the voters have been defeated. Now, what I think is interesting is that, as I read more closely about this, that The Catholic Church does not have a problem with patients refusing certain kinds of treatments that might prolong their lives. Right. So it's been raised, Dr. Young, and maybe you want to weigh in on this, but if you don't, that's okay. That if you remove a feeding tube or you stop a ventilator, you know, how is that different from deciding that I'm going to take Secanol, I'm competent, I know what's going on?
I think, and it's very much a moral issue, not just a religious one, and I am familiar with the Catholic Church's stance on this. I think that their view of this is that in these instances, the patient is either moribund or comatose. In the case of a feeding tube, depending on the mental status of the patient, that makes a big difference as to when you would stop treatment. That is, to the Catholic Church, that is something that is very different from a patient deciding, despite all the circumstances that we've been talking about, deciding to end their life no matter what manner that they do it.
Doctor, I know that you are very much pleased with the changes in attitude about end-of-life care. And for you, that's a strong reason to not have to need this. Tell us why.
That's correct. I think that, and Dr. Angel did mention about palliative care and hospice and those sorts of programs and such that are in our state and are excellent, as they are in Oregon and Washington State. But those are also places where patients and where our patients go to end their lives, and it does involve medication there also. But it is ended in a, what we feel, a more patient-centered, patient-oriented, humane method.
Here's something that I thought was interesting. You know, many people have weighed in on this subject, as you can imagine, all around the country, looking at the example of Oregon and Washington and now turning toward perhaps Massachusetts. This was a piece written by an ethicist and professor at Augustana College, which is in Rock Island, Illinois. And he says, when all things are considered, the arguments in favor of continued prohibition of physician-assisted suicide are not particularly compelling. And he goes on to say, it's perfectly appropriate to maintain moral reservations. He does. But he said that was not enough to, quote, stand in the way of those who want to make a different choice. Marcia Angel, I would imagine you agree.
Very much so. I think palliative care is wonderful. And as Linda Young said, it is very good in the state of Oregon. Usually it's sufficient, but it's up to the patient to decide if it's not. And to say that you can't permit a physician-assisted dying because you have palliative care, good palliative care, is as though you said you can't have heart transplantation because we have good heart drugs. This is for when the patient decides that the palliative care has not worked. Mm. It should be the patient's decision.
Something else that's interesting that's come out of both the Oregon and Washington experience is that a lot of people get the drug and then decide not to take it. Now, two things happen. One, they may pass away before they had time to take it. But in a lot of cases, they just change their minds. And that's okay, too. You don't have to take it if you get the drug, just to put that on the table.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And of the people who get the prescription for the drug in Oregon, fully a third just keep it on their bedside table. They keep it on the bedside table in case things get too bad and they want to use it. It gives them peace of mind, and it allows them to go on living longer than they probably would otherwise.
So, Dr. Young, given that we know that a lot of people, some people just change their minds. They don't pass away, but they just change their minds. Why not allow those who want to have the opportunity to take this method, use it, but understanding that there's a lot of leeway here for people to change their minds. Nobody's forcing you once you get it.
Well, I think the important thing to realize, too, is that with the law, it doesn't say that a physician has to do this. It would be up to the individual physician. If you don't want to prescribe this medication, you don't have to. So there are still a number of physicians out there, including 25% of our members, that feel that this is definitely okay to do. So it is definitely a matter of choice. But I think that we're going back to the ethical issue that the majority of us feel in organized medicine and probably out there in general medicine, that we're meant to heal and we aren't meant to, as a lot of people look at this, to harm.
I am talking about the ballot question, one of the three ballot questions that'll be on the November ballot. This one is about the Death with Dignity Act, sometimes known as physician-assisted suicide. I'm speaking with Dr. Marcia Angel, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Dr. Linda Young, former president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. They are on opposite sides of this issue. And I should note that we will be revisiting this issue as part of our 30 Issues in 30 Days coverage. WGBH News will be talking about the issues that voters will be thinking about as they head to the polls in November. So if this is your first time hearing about it, you'll have another opportunity to revisit as we get closer to the November voting day. So the people who are proponents of this law, Dr. Angel, had to get signatures to get on the ballot.
Yes.
They needed 68,000. They got 86,000. Then they got 21 more thousand votes, which suggests significant interest. And I just got this poll from public policy polling saying that 58% of Bay Staters at this point are in favor, 24% are opposed, and 18% undecided. That's a little bit of a drop from the Western New England University poll, which was in May, where 60% were in favor, 29% opposed, and 11% undecided. Now, that's Massachusetts. Nationally, about 60% of folks seem to be leaning toward this. But yet, I have to say, here we are. This is Massachusetts just coming up with the question, and there's only two states, both of them in the West, that have actually gone forward. So what do you say about what is apparent interest, but yet not support legislatively?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. The majority who favor it, I think, reflects the fact that nearly everyone has a loved one or knows someone who has died a protracted, difficult death. And they have wanted more than anything to see them get the release that they want. So I think the fact that in polls most people favor it reflects their real world experience. But then some people, when they get into the ballot booth, they have heard the arguments against it, the sort of scare tales against it. They see on the ballot all of the small print that is meant there as safeguards, but seems a little overwhelming to people who actually go in. I think at that point some of them may pull back. Yeah. The last time I think was Maine.
Right.
And they pulled back, even though the polls showed the majority in favor of it. They pulled back at the last minute. I think that won't happen. For a while I thought this was going to be 50-50 in Massachusetts. I think we're going to win. Because I think the education has been so good, shows like this one, to try to acquaint people with what the issues are and with how it's worked in Oregon. This is very important. And with all of the safeguards, I think it's going to happen this time, and I certainly hope it does.
Well, Dr. Angel, you have a personal story about, you were talking about a loved one with protracted illness. This is not the only reason I imagine that you're in support, but a big part.
It affirmed the support I already felt. This you're referring to my father, who in 1988, suffering from metastatic cancer of the prostate, took a pistol from his bedside table and shot himself, died instantly. He did this rather than endure a protracted death. The reason he chose that time is that earlier that evening he had fallen while walking to his bed. My mother had to phone the EMTs to pick him up because she wasn't able to do it. The EMTs came that evening and they said, they put him to bed and they said, "We'll come tomorrow and take you to the hospital to make sure you didn't break a bone in the fall." He knew that that might be his last chance. He couldn't take his pistol with him to the hospital. He might lose the opportunity. And so that was the night he chose to end his life. I have no doubt that if Florida at that time had had the Oregon law, he would not have died that night. He probably, I don't know whether he had 6 months to live or 7 months to live or even a year, but I think he would have lived longer with the security that came from knowing that he had control over the circumstances of his death, the exact timing and the manner of his death. So this violent death and the shock it was for my mother to find his body, I think that was too early and too violent, and it wouldn't happen in Oregon, wouldn't happen in Washington, and I certainly hope that after November 6th it won't happen in Massachusetts.
So, Dr. Young, that's a powerful and emotional story. And one of the things I hear so much sitting at this table and behind this microphone is from people who say, you cannot legislate in from emotion, that you have to understand it, but then think clearly about some of the other issues. So make the case for people having heard that to say, you got to think about some other things too.
Well, and it is very difficult because that's exactly what happened when our medical society was debating this, because people were getting up and saying things like that or to the opposite end of, I had a patient once who was diagnosed with this and lived another 5 years. Those sorts of stories are very compelling. And I think that, as Dr. Angel said, it's very important to have the patient have the choice to do this. We heard testimony from psychiatrists. We heard testimony from palliative care doctors, very much different. Psychiatrists saying that they had patients that stockpiled their pain medications so that at a moment of choosing, should they want to, they could overdose on their pain medicine. So I know that this goes on. We do know this. But in fact, we also have some difficulty, not just with the ethical business, but we also have some difficulty with some of the safeguards that may or may not be there. We're concerned.
Like what?
Yet, well, it didn't happen in Oregon, so I think that's saying in 15 years' time it hasn't happened. But the abuse of this that could come about, the fact that they need to have, the physician that writes the prescription is the one that is pretty much responsible for deciding that his patient or her patient is in fact mentally able to do this, and not requiring that they have a separate independent psychiatric evaluation, whether or not you feel that's necessary, but that is one of the issues that was brought up. And then the other part to this was also that you need to have somebody signing this. And some people said, well, you know, it says one person doesn't have to be an heir, but how do you know that that's the case? And this isn't something that has a vested interest in this particular person ending their life. So those are some of the safeguards that have been brought up that we feel are not either not in place or not strong enough for this law.
If they were in place, if it, you know, because it can always be amended. One, I mean, these things can happen. If the bill was to pass, would you be more with this? I'm not just you, but would the Massachusetts Medical Society be more comfortable?
I don't think we would get past the unethical issue. And I think that it would be very difficult to do just that with those safeguards, as they say. I think it would be very hard to put those into place, if not impossible.
So I'm of the opinion, and I have these facts to support it, that the baby boomers are pushing in a way that they might, that this bill may not have gotten as much, as far as it's gotten in Massachusetts. But now we know the oldest baby boomers turned 65 in 2011, and in 2030, 61 million boomers will be between the ages of 66 and 84 years of age. Gotta say, for that group, they're pretty used to driving their own train. You know, so I think that not only the sort of attitude about I'll make my own decisions, Marcia Angel, but also they've been a part of a sandwich generation of taking care of someone with a protracted illness that you suggest have been the experience of many people. And it just feels to me that in Massachusetts, that cohort is really pushing in ways that maybe not in the past.
Well, are you implying that as the insides of the sandwich, that they are eager to get their parents out of the way?
No, I'm just implying that, you know, that they would like to, you know, have this as an option.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. Well, I don't think it's a boomer issue. I think it's a human issue. You know, back when I was in training, even withdrawing life-sustaining treatment was considered tantamount to euthanasia. This was back in the 60s, way back in the olden days.
Is that gone now? I'm not certain that isn't still the case.
Oh, Now it's understood
okay.
that you can remove a feeding tube, you can remove a mechanical ventilator, you don't have to do dialysis. All of this is accepted, but it wasn't. It wasn't until 1990, really, that this was accepted throughout the country. And so what if you don't have some life-sustaining technology that can be removed? That's what this law deals with. You could have disseminated lung cancer and be on a ventilator, and if you wanted to remove that ventilator, you could do that. But suppose you had disseminated cancer of the pancreas and you were suffering just as terribly, but you didn't have to be on a technology to stay alive, then what? And so the Death with Dignity Act speaks to this situation in which people find their suffering intolerable, but there is no technology to remove.
That's my guest, Dr. Marcia Angel. She's a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. My other guest is Dr. Linda Young, former president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. So I'm curious to know, Dr. Young, if you have a prediction of how you think this will go in November.
Well, of course, I think that the opponents are going to win. I think that, as Dr. Angel had said, one of the things that strikes me as she was speaking, that when you go into the voting booth and you look at these ballot questions, unless you've studied them and know exactly what they're about, and you see all that little print there and you think, ooh, maybe this isn't something that I'm comfortable voting for or against. And I'm thinking that perhaps, in addition to the education that's been going on, both pro and con, perhaps religion will come into this also, that it will probably get defeated just because of those things that we had just talked about.
Do you think that the issue of cost might come up? It's the actual medicine itself is not very expensive, but people may compare, staying on some long-term, ventilator or whatever, now again, these people have to be mentally competent, so they can't be moribund, as you said before, to do this versus, this is a least expensive alternative for me in my life. Because people look at, do I have enough health insurance? How's this going to impact my family? I don't want them going into bankruptcy, blah, blah, blah. Do you think that's a factor as well?
Those are issues that have been brought up. As a matter of fact, there is in the press recently, there have been those stories, in particular the woman in Oregon who was on the state health insurance who said, we're not going to pay for your hospice, but oh, by the way, we'll pay for your pill to end your life. And I think that certainly raised a huge issue with, is it cheaper to do this, or is it better, not necessarily cheaper, to do the end-of-life care, hospice, palliative care, that sort of thing? Certainly it's more expensive to do the latter. But I don't see the cost issue, although it may still come out, I don't see the cost issue as being, I think that's a real slippery slope, is to say, well, it's cheaper if you kill yourself.
Yeah, so. I take it that insurance company never did that again. That was that doesn't happen anymore. I don't know what happened there. That was, oof. Dr. Angel, you want to address the cost issue?
Yeah, I was going to say that one of the most reassuring aspects of the experience in Oregon is that the fears that this might be used by poor people, uninsured people, people who are disadvantaged in other ways, disabled people, this has not come to pass. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. The people who have used this law have been, on average, more affluent, better educated, well insured. In a sense, they were the kinds of people who valued control over the circumstances of their lives, which my father did. And we celebrate that when people are healthy. We say, oh, this person is in control of his life, he's independent. And why should we, when they are dying, suddenly say, no, we don't value that. We don't want you to have control. We don't want you to be independent. We don't want you to make up your own mind. It's sort of an odd thing. But anyway, the people in Oregon have been well insured, and this has not been an issue.
What was the turning point? Because I know you've done a lot of looking at the Oregon and Washington law. They're virtually identical. That's why we keep putting them together in the same sentence. To really get the electorate to vote it in, originally, if we can look back, that might be in play here in Massachusetts. What do you think the turning point was?
Well,
and I asked that, but let me just say that I asked that because we'd had the Jack Kevorkian stories. That was the doctor who was, you know, filming himself, injecting people, and that just did not work even for people who supported it.
Oh, no. In Oregon, I think they learned from the failures in California and Washington State before that. I mean, later on, Washington State adopted the same law as Oregon. But earlier, they had had laws that had fewer safeguards or tried to pass them, and they failed. And so Oregon realized that the law had to be very narrowly crafted, that it had to be only for adults, only competent, only near death, and it could not include euthanasia. The patients had to be able to swallow a full glass of liquid, which ensures that it's voluntary. Doctors would not be permitted to inject a lethal substance. Doing this, narrowing the people who would be qualified for this law, I think enabled it to pass when broader laws in California and Washington had failed. But this law does exclude certain people who are suffering, people with Alzheimer's disease, people with Lou Gehrig's disease early in the course, people who may not be fully mentally competent. But that's the price you pay, to have a law with sufficient safeguards so people feel comfortable with it.
It occurs to me that there may be people who don't understand what happens in the moment. So, as we've said, the patient gets the drug, it's secanol, it's a barbiturate, and then they can drink it, and it's usually mixed with something apparently has a horrible taste. So they mix it, and then they have time. Either it doesn't happen instantly, and then they kind of go in what looks like sleep. It's a coma, and then they pass away. So it's really a kind of quiet.
Anyone who's ever had major surgery and has anesthetic knows what that feels like. You get the anesthetic, you're dizzy for just a second, and the next thing you know, you wake up in the recovery room. Here you don't wake up in the recovery room. But that's what it is. It's an overdose of a sleeping medication.
This is from our Facebook page. I wanted to read this and get you both to respond to it. Donna Maria wrote, I fully support the patient's right to this and disagree with your other guests who insist doctors who don't support this are uncomfortable with, quote, not healing, unquote, and standing by the Hippocratic Oath. In today's medicine, the majority of people who are suffering and need, that's in caps, this available, are never, again in caps, going to be healed. They are merely being kept alive by technology and medication and have no kind of quality of life at all, exclamation point. Patients are merely being kept alive, and regarding unethical, why is it not unethical to keep people alive beyond what is natural and normal? When people are being kept alive with technology and medication only, how is that ethical when all it does is extend suffering? So, Dr. Linda Young, that was directed toward you, so I'll let you answer that.
Again, here's where the emotion comes into this, and I think that if you have experience with seeing a vast number of people, not just perhaps a few or family member or whatever, which is horrific in itself, having also been in that position, I think that we always have hope, and I think that's one thing that many physicians, no matter what you're doing, whether you're a generalist or a specialist, you always feel that there's hope that something may come along, that something may alleviate, or perhaps even, although maybe not in this case, maybe even cure. So I think that a lot of times we just don't want to give up because many or too many times we've seen where this could have been and has been reversed. Now, I know I'm not talking about the majority of people that are in this situation. But I think that we have, in general, we have much more hope and want to make the patient as comfortable as possible. But we also realize that they have a right to refuse treatments that may or may not prolong their life. If they choose to have, there's other issues going on where perhaps a physician may say, I'm not comfortable doing this, but there are other outlets where you can have this done. I think that's a whole other issue that may or may not need to be addressed. It does not come up in this particular bill.
This is not about physicians. This is about patients. We have to remember this. Yes, physicians should heal, but as your letter writer said, this isn't when healing is possible. Healing is not possible for these patients. So then what physicians should be doing is concentrating on relieving their suffering as they wish, with respect for the patient's autonomy. Physicians seem to me, organized medicine that opposes this. Not everyone in organized medicine opposes it, and not all organizations oppose it. The American Medical Women's Association supports physician-assisted dying. The American Medical Students Association also supports it. The AMA opposes it. The Massachusetts Medical Society opposes it. But when they oppose it, it seems to me that they are too engaged with their own self-image. They say, this is what we do. We have hope. We heal. And medicine should be more specific, less abstract, less one size fits all. It should be an individual doctor dealing with the individual circumstances of that patient and what that patient needs and desires. And it's about patients.
All right. We've been talking about the Right to Die ballot measure that voters in Massachusetts will go to the polls and vote on November 6th with Dr. Marcia Angel and Dr. Linda Young. Thank you both so much for talking to us about this important ballot measure.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Kara Miller is back in Studio 3.
Hey, Kelly. So at the Democratic National Convention last night, we heard Governor Patrick cite the Orchard Garden School in Roxbury as a success story. And we're going to be picking up on that theme of education with writer Paul Tough. He thinks a lot about how you educate kids and what it takes for them to really succeed. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.